Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody, along with Steve Goldstein. In Valley traffic, the 60 westbound Grand Avenue is closed at Indian School Road due to a crash. Need to find another way around that area. Look for sunny skies for the rest of the afternoon with a high forecast today of 88 degrees. We have tied the record high for this day. It's 84 degrees at KJZZ.
Two female students died this morning at Independence High School in Glendale. The 15-year-olds were found dead on campus with a gun nearby. KJZZ's Matthew Casey has been covering the situation and joins me. Matt, what do we know now?
Not very much, Steve. We know that these girls were 15 years old. Glendale police have confirmed that they were students at the school. Investigators found their bodies under a patioed covered area near the administration building. And as you mentioned, they did find a gun nearby. Police say they're not looking for other suspects or persons of interest at that time. And I think that's a key detail.
As we mentioned, this happened on a high school campus. So how are school officials responding?
At about 11 o'clock, they were using buses to bring parents to campus from a nearby staging area so they could be reunited with their children. District officials say they're focused on helping students, faculty, and staff cope with what has happened. It's a long weekend for these kids because Monday is President's Day and they're off. The superintendent says he expects school to resume on Tuesday, and the district will have grief counseling, any kind of services students need on Tuesday.
Now that we know that the campus is secure and that our students are safe, our focus is on our students, our faculty, and our staff, ensuring that they have the appropriate support to get through this.
That's Brian Capistron, superintendent of Glendale Unified High School District. And Matt, finally, what information are we still waiting to find out, the key information?
The biggest question, Steve, is why are these girls dead? What led to this tragedy? Police have not identified them yet. But I think the fact that police say they are not currently looking for other suspects suggests it may have been a murder-suicide. But they also say they're in the very early stages of their investigation, and it's just too early to tell exactly what happened.
KJZZ's Matthew Casey with the latest on the deaths of two 15-year-old female students this morning at Independence High School in Glendale. Matt, thanks for the update.
Thank you, Steve.
Two measures working their way through the state legislature would ask voters to make changes to agencies they've previously voted to set up. One would eliminate the Clean Elections Commission's rulemaking authority. The other would require members of the Independent Redistricting Commission to be elected statewide rather than appointed as they are now. Joining me to talk about these proposals is reporter Jeremy Duda of the Arizona Capital Times. Jeremy, let's start with clean elections. This seems to be in response to the panel trying to regulate both so-called dark money and candidates who are not using the program.
Well, I think this is pretty much all related to that. For the past few years, and especially last year, there's been a lot of disagreement between the Clean Elections Commission and folks in the legislature and Secretary of State's office over how far the Clean Elections Commission's authority extends. Last year, there was a very long, drawn-out fight over a proposed rule that the commission ended up passing, where they kind of added on to the statutory definition of what constitutes a political committee. In the commission's words, they clarified this. Now, the Secretary of State's office folks in the legislature say they did not have that authority. The commission says they did. The Secretary of State's office, Michelle Reagan, and her elections director, Eric Spencer, went to the Governor's Regulatory Review Council to try and shoot that down. The council ordered them to repeal it. Sounds like they're just simply going to ignore that. They do not believe that the council has that authority.
Another elections-related bill making its way through the legislature would essentially require that anybody who is to serve on the Independent Redistricting Commission, the group that draws legislative and congressional district lines, be elected statewide. And critics are saying, well, that's just going to ensure that every member of that panel is a Republican, as opposed to the current makeup of two Republicans, two Democrats, and an independent.
Well, that certainly seems likely. If you have, five members of the redistricting commission who are all elected statewide, obviously this is a predominantly Republican state, and I think if you want to want something that will give kind of a blueprint for how this will likely to play out, you need only to look at the Corporation Commission, where you have five members who are all elected statewide. They are all five right now are Republicans. It's been that way for the past couple of election cycles. So it seems likely that this situation, that this, if this passes, and of course this has to go to the voters first, the voters have to approve that, but if the voters were to do so, then all five of these positions would be elected statewide, and it seems likely that the majority, if not all, would be, all those seats would go to Republicans.
What do you think the odds are that if one or both of these measures are enacted, that they lead to a lawsuit?
Well, I don't know that it would lead to a lawsuit. I mean, basically, they would both be voter approved. Both of these would have to go to the voters for approval. It's state statute, state law, or the state constitution. I don't know what kind of recourse they would have if they go to the ballot. I think opponents of these measures are going to have to go to fight them, and that's where things could get interesting. I don't know if the proponents of these measures actually have spoken to folks about funding any kind of vote yes campaign. A lot of the times, in the legislature, you'll see people propose these ballot referrals that even though it seems like something that the majority of the legislature would support, they don't really go anywhere. And one of the reasons is because you never want to refer something to the ballot unless you have a pretty good idea of how that campaign is going to play out, unless you know who is going to be funding your campaign.
Do you think that given the effort to put the ballot measures dealing with dark money and the open primaries on the ballot, do you think that would play any role or have any effect on potential campaigns on these issues?
They could. I mean, the dark money issue is something that is kind of tangentially related to the clean elections issue. I mean, really, that's what this is all about. And that's probably what the campaign would become about. But if you can tie it to that issue, you might be able to round up some no votes based on that, say that the politicians are trying to protect dark money. I'm sure that is how the opponents of that would frame that.
Jeremy Duda is a reporter with the Arizona Capital Times. Jeremy, thanks as always.
All right, thanks a lot, Mark.
The signing of SB 1070 by then-Governor Jan Brewer highlighted Arizona as a state that was determined to pass legislation that was meant to be tough on undocumented immigrants. But a recent piece in the New York Times opines that in 2016, current Governor Doug Ducey seems to be putting less emphasis on that. To learn more about whether that's perception or reality, I'm joined by ASU political scientist Lisa Magana. Lisa, has this been a change? Governor Ducey did talk a lot about border security when he was running for office.
Well, that's a really great point. In fact, remember, he really pushed for the Arpaio endorsement, and that certainly has shifted as well. I think overall, this sort of push for anti-immigrant legislation hasn't really worked out for a lot of states, including Arizona. And a good example would be all the boycotts and all the economic devastation after SB 1070 and, in terms of businesses, in-state tuition, certainly tourism.
So you think we're seeing that again, where Governor Ducey is trying to be conservative but trying to frame himself as a pro-business conservative rather than a social conservative?
Yeah, I think that we're seeing a lot of it. And some of the narrative now, we're going to put border guards at the border, but not because of immigration, but because of drug smugglers. And, who doesn't hate drug smugglers? And I think politically, it's probably smart. In the short term, when we think about Latino politics, it's great if we are, trying to look like we're tough on immigration, but it certainly comes off as anti-Latino. And we know that this isn't necessarily going to work in the long run because of, demographics and so on. I think it's wise for the governor to stay out of this, obviously, very contentious issue. And I think it's also thinking in the long term.
Do you think if he does keep focusing on the economy and jobs and keeps having this mantra of improving funding for education, do you think the state's reputation can turn around if, in fact, its chief executive almost ignores the topic?
Yes, I absolutely do. I think it's, and he's one of the first governors, I think, in 10 years that's actually gone to Mexico, working on encouraging better trade relations. And I think, that was also devastated by the impact of SB 1070. We can disagree about the motivation of why people come to the country illegally, but we certainly know that there was definitely an economic impact after SB 1070. And, reputation-wise, I think it really did get a big whack.
Is it possible for a politician to be able to sort of play both sides of the quote-unquote fence and say, yes, we are going to go after these people who we all know are bad, but other than that, I'm not going to risk Arizona taking another economic hit? Can a politician have that balance?
I think so. And, in Texas, the governor was a little bit more, I would say, anti- immigration with sort of a very similar policy. Actually, it was more money that they were going to put in Texas. But I think this has been a good agenda.
Is this the kind of thing where maybe you don't necessarily get many young Latinos, those who are eligible to vote, who would vote for Governor Ducey, but maybe by doing something like this, people won't be voting against him?
Yes, I think that's absolutely true. So you can't vote unless you're a U.S. citizen. And we know that the number of people naturalizing, so they could be legal permanent residents, are becoming U.S. citizens. One of the main reasons, according to the surveys, is that they're saying, listen, for the first time, I want to vote because I don't like this guy. I don't like this woman. I want him or her out of office. Mm-hmm. And so it's actually kind of counterintuitive in some ways that the anti-immigration legislation actually mobilizes people politically. You know, in some ways, it doesn't serve to diminish. It actually galvanizes people.
ASU political scientist Lisa Magana. Lisa, thank you as always.
My pleasure.
Last summer, we visited a North Phoenix RV park where residents complained of a smell so caustic it was affecting their health and well-being.
They claimed it was coming from a nearby facility that specialized in recycling green waste and said complaints to the city of Phoenix were falling on deaf ears. KJZZ's Phil Lastman recently revisited the site to find out if things had improved.
6 months ago, in the sweltering August heat, the smell of rotting composting materials was overwhelming. We met Diana Ellis and Phyllis Younger at the Desert's Edge RV Park in the Deer Valley section of the city.
The smell, suffering with burning, hurting, itching eyes, sneezing.
You go, like we did this morning, to go do laundry, you walk out the door and it's like suffocating.
6 months later and significantly cooler, the smell is more tolerable. The machines have stopped operating at the Green Earth recycling plant across the street. But the piles remain, and the problem hasn't gone away either.
Some of it has improved, but some of it hasn't. I still get headaches, and I still cough like a stevedore when that smell gets around.
There are days when there is horrendous odor. It's in the air. You can see it. You can smell it.
Following a series of complaints and an investigation, the city of Phoenix ordered the plant closed and for operations to cease by December 31st. Ellis, a resident and the manager of the neighboring Phoenix Metro RV Park, says operators of the plant initially ignored the city's orders and are now dragging their feet on cleaning up the rotting compost.
I feel like they have set deadlines. Overridden, given more time for whatever reason unknown to me, the same thing continues to happen, and then the Green Earth just up and walks away from it, and all those piles are still sitting there.
Sandra Brin, who manages the Desert's Edge RV Park and has spearheaded efforts against the recycling plant, says there's been a lot of talk, but not a lot of action from the city.
Because the city of Phoenix has not been enforcing their own regulations, and because they have left the materials on site, it's not finished.
According to Councilwoman Felda Williams, they're doing their best. She represents the district on the Phoenix City Council.
Stall tactics, as far as I'm concerned. Nothing has been removed, nothing has changed, and they will pay the price, ultimate price.
That price in the form of fines. Mike Espinosa is Green Earth's owner. He claims it was bad press, not bad smells, that shut them down.
Negative publicity from radio stations, newspapers, TV, everything forced us out of that facility.
Furthermore, he contends the city's order makes it impossible for him to clean up the mess.
Green Earth is not authorized or nor permitted to haul any material out of there. They're saying, hey, you have 3 months to clean 2.5 years worth of material that came in. Come on, that ain't gonna happen.
William says that's not true and that the owners have never made an effort to comply.
He has the responsibility. He owns the property. The owners of this company did not control the dust or the odors.
Espinosa maintains the odor has not been found to be hazardous and wasn't even coming from his plant, but from the nearby waste management facility instead, a claim that William says also isn't true. In the meantime, at nearby Desert's Edge, Phyllis Younger says the city doesn't care about their plight.
We're the ones suffering. They're not. They're sitting up in their posh little houses and not smelling it. We're the ones smelling it. We live here permanently.
Councilwoman Williams says that also couldn't be further from the truth.
I don't care where you live. You're just a valuable person in the city of Phoenix. Unfortunately, when you have someone that's contrary to following the regulations, circumstances like this happen.
Williams recently sent a letter to City Manager Ed Zuercher asking for immediate action and swift enforcement, claiming the plant's owners are not complying with orders to vacate and remediate. In North Phoenix, for the show, Phil Latzman, KJZZ News.
Arizona pioneered the school choice movement in the 1990s, and now, two decades later, the numbers are in. The Arizona Center for Investigative Reporting did a deep dive into the state's enrollment data and found white and especially Asian students attend charter schools at higher rates than Hispanics, even though they now make up the greatest portion of Arizona's school-age population. The show's Lauren Gilger is here to tell us what they found. Hi, Lauren.
Hi, Mark.
So the school choice movement is all about charter schools. How does Arizona compare to the rest of the country in this area?
Well, it's very prevalent here. In Arizona, roughly 17% of all students in public schools go to charter schools. The national average is just 5%.
And charter schools here receive state funding.
Right. That was one of the ideas behind the school choice movement, that charter schools receive state funding based on enrollment, and they operate independently of school districts. I talked with Evan Wyloge, one of the reporters on the story, and here's how he described it.
You know, some kids may want to go to an arts school. Other parents may want to have their kids in a very disciplined setting. Charter schools allow for that. They let these schools kind of decide what their curriculum and their standards are going to be, and the parents can then choose to send their kids to someplace more tailored. But basically, advocates for the traditional district school model argue that that kind of a system connects communities together around the school, and that if the school isn't reflective of the community it's in, that we lose that kind of community center.
So there are high-achieving charter schools in the state and some on the other side of the spectrum for at-risk kids. How do those break down along ethnic lines?
They found that schools they categorized as rigorous or progressive tended to have more white students, whereas schools categorized as at-risk, which cater to students at risk of failing out of school, were overwhelmingly Hispanic.
But Lauren, in Arizona, we're an open enrollment state. Students can basically go to school wherever they choose, no matter where they live. So why is it that charter schools are less diverse?
Well, Wyloge says charter schools in Arizona are not allowed to charge students to get in or make them pass a test to get in, but he says they found there are other barriers.
Like an information gap. You know, the socioeconomic status and information gap relationship is something that's been studied by social scientists for a long time. And what it says is that people of lower socioeconomic status basically just are not as aware of the systems that are out there available to them. So they don't know necessarily that these systems are available to them. They don't know how to take advantage of these systems. And so you've got lower socioeconomic status kind of determining, or at least a determining factor in who's going to be taking advantage of the charter school system.
And Wyloge says Chicanos por la Causa, a local nonprofit that works in the Hispanic community here, found this to be true right here in Phoenix. They surveyed a group of parents here, and they actually had the perception that charter schools were private schools.
So how did the Arizona Charter Schools Association respond to this?
They were at least anecdotally aware of it. Wyloge says they told them they actually have a program that's aimed at developing charter schools in minority-heavy areas.
They say that one of their goals is to, you know, provide this kind of access or these opportunities to anyone and everyone across the state, irrespective of their income, their ethnicity, any of that. They do have some specific programs aimed at trying to increase access to charter schools for high minority areas and low income families. And they've actually been able to launch a few of those schools under a new initiative called the New Schools for Phoenix. We went and visited one of the schools, and it was actually very reflective of the community it was in. That neighborhood is roughly 90% Hispanic, and the school is 90% Hispanic.
That's Evan Wyloge. He's a reporter for the Arizona Center for Investigative Reporting. He reported on uneven distribution of ethnic groups in Arizona schools.
Thanks, Lauren.
Thanks, Mark.
Arizona lawmakers are debating whether to allow electronic billboards through most of La Paz and Mojave counties. Current law only allows them along a corridor from Phoenix towards California along I-10 and I-8. The push is coming from Lamar Advertising. Tim Lasota represents the company. And Tim, why does your client want to put up electronic billboards in this part of the state?
This is a right that essentially other businesses in other parts of the state enjoy. And the area we have asked to include in the area where billboards can be put is an area that is nowhere near any observatories, and it's already subject to significant light pollution from Las Vegas and Laughlin. So there's really no reason why they shouldn't be allowed. The last time the legislature did something on this subject, our area wasn't included simply out of lack of an interest at that time.
So it sounds like you don't really make much of the concerns of astronomers and other the dark skies community that this would potentially be a problem.
Well, this is the area that it is allowed in is over 100 miles from any observatory. And as I said before, it's already subject to significant light pollution from Nevada. So I do think those concerns are, obviously that the legislature listens to different concerns all the time, but I don't think those concerns outweigh our concern is that we be treated fairly and the same as other businesses under similar circumstances.
Are there particular businesses that are really jonesing to advertise in this part of the state?
Well, the billboard industry is obviously a competitive one. And when you have certain sets of rules that benefit or allow certain companies to do certain things, but then the rules don't allow other companies to do the same thing, I think that's the issue that we're getting at. And it's a fairness issue.
Now, my understanding is that even if this law goes into effect, that there would still potentially be local or county regulations that could be in effect that could preclude your client and others from putting up these billboards. Is that a concern for you?
That is absolutely correct. And no, it is not a concern. We think that local government is fully capable of making these types of decisions.
Do you have any measure of certainty that any of the cities or the counties in which you're dealing would allow these billboards to go up?
Yes, a number of cities have addressed it. Bullhead City allows them. Kingman allows them. That's just two examples. And those determinations have been made essentially by those communities and listening to local input on what their local residents think is appropriate.
Tim Lasota represents Lamar Advertising, which is advocating for House Bill 2507, which would open up more of the state to electronic billboards. As we reference, members of the Dark Skies community aren't happy about this. Sierra Vista resident Bob Gent is the past president of the board of directors of the International Dark Skies Association. And Bob, what do you make of this new effort?
Yeah, I was kind of disappointed in that. Electronic billboards, basically, to me, in a state like Arizona, they just don't have a place, especially in rural Arizona. Those areas that are being opened up border on some really scenic area, National Park, the Lake Mead National Recreation Area, parts of national monuments. I just think billboards can be pretty ugly, pretty distracting. And we have such scenic beauty in Arizona. Do we really want to destroy it with ugly, bright billboards that would be up there all the time? I think not.
One of the arguments that the sponsor of the bill is making is that it's not fair that businesses in some parts of the state can advertise on these kinds of billboards while others cannot. Is that an argument that you find compelling at all?
Not really. You know, the billboard industry came down to Cochise County on several occasions, and particularly in our area. And our city council has heard from the residents, we just don't want billboards, period. In fact, even the businesses that want to advertise with new electronic signs, we've set a lot of restrictions on how big the signs can be, how tall they can be, how bright they can be at night. But those are only for on-premise business signs, and they're replacing other signs. Billboards are strictly prohibited.
If this bill is ultimately passed by the legislature and signed into law by the governor, would you encourage city and county governments in your neck of the woods and in other parts of the state as well to continue to say, yeah, we don't want these, let's keep them out?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we worked hard here in Cochise County and Sierra Vista to stop some overly bright signs in the past, and we'll continue to do that. Not only are they a distraction to drivers, I mean, if you're going down the highway and you see this big digital sign billboard, it's really distracting, and it's it's kind of like trying to drive and text and talk on the phone and watch your instrumentation and pay attention to all the hazards on the road at the same time. Now you're trying to compete with a billboard that's flashing to get your attention. It's just not safe. We don't need that distraction on our highways, and it's ugly.
Bob Gent is the past president of the board of directors of the International Dark Skies Association, talking about House Bill 2507, which would open up much of Mojave and La Paz counties to electronic billboards.
It helped Phoenix grow more than 100 years ago. It also introduced Valley residents to a new way to get around. As Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez tells us, today's system in a lot of ways mirrors the old.
For the past few years, the Metro Light Rail has connected downtown Phoenix to Valley cities. For local travelers, this has been a new mode of transportation for the Valley. Well, it isn't. Did you know Phoenix had a commuter street railway system about 125 years ago?
The Phoenix Street Railway was founded in the 1880s.
Rob Bohannon is president of the Arizona Rail Passenger Association.
And it was triggered by the fact that in 1886, Phoenix had its first railroad service, a branch line from Maricopa. And when the railroad arrived in town, then that got the city fathers to thinking about how we ought to have a streetcar line.
Bohannon says the Phoenix Street Railway transportation system was created to expand rapid transit and to extend the city. The line started on Washington Street around Central Avenue with a car on narrow rail tracks pulled by mules, and it traveled a short distance around the small city. By the early 1890s, electric cars were added on standard railroad tracks. By 1901, service was extended to North Phoenix.
Went up First Street and then jogged over to Third Street and then went up Third Street as far as Indian School.
By 1911, another line was added, the Glendale Extension. This path went past the Indian School stop into the Orangewood District around Glendale and 7th Avenues, and it stretched out to 58th Avenue. The line served to transport passengers, produce, and mail between Phoenix and Glendale.
The original line out to Glendale was never a financial success. The system, it was privately operated until the 20s. Essentially what happened in the late 1920s is it went bankrupt and the city took it over.
The city added modern cars, created extensions into more communities, and changed the name to the Phoenix Railway Company. The rail lines ran successfully until 1948, when it shut down. Bohannon says several factors contributed to the folding of the system.
During the last half of the 20th century, the streetcar lines were abandoned in favor of buses and in favor of freeways and automobiles and so forth. And now we're coming full circle.
That's because several of the current Metro Light Rail line today run parallel to the Phoenix Rail line of the early 1900s. It's the show. I'm Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez.
If you know things we should know, send us a note. The show at KJZZ.org. Concerns about chemical warfare hang over many of the battles currently taking place around the world, including in Syria. But using gases and toxins in warfare is hardly new. One of the starkest examples comes from Vietnam, where the U.S. sprayed plant-killing chemicals in the effort to destroy crops and eliminate forest cover. One of those chemicals was known as Agent Orange, and exposure to it has affected Vietnam veterans for decades. On Saturday morning in Mesa, the Vietnam Veterans of America Chapter 1011 will hold an Agent Orange town hall meeting to inform veterans and non-veterans alike about the continuing effects. I'm joined now by Chuck Byers, Chief Veterans Service Officer for the Vietnam Veterans for the state of Arizona. Chuck, how widely used was Agent Orange?
It was used quite heavily in Vietnam, but also was used in Thailand. It was used in Korea, and it also was here in the United States. At Fort McClellan, Alabama, we have Elgin Air Force Base. And, you know, we're starting to see that there's even other areas where it's propped up.
Can we talk briefly about some of the illnesses that have sprouted up because directly related to Agent Orange?
There are 14 presumptive diseases that are associated with Agent Orange: prostate cancer, diabetes, And what we're starting to see more and more now at our age, Parkinson's, ischemic heart, that's coronary artery disease. There's different types of cancers, leukemia. But more importantly is that this is affecting the veterans, but we are now starting to see that it's starting to affect the dependents of the veterans.
How has that manifested itself? And were there expectations this would happen? Did anyone think that could happen?
No, I don't think they realized the effects of what this dioxin and the amount that it was used was going to have these lasting effects for generations. My daughter was born with cleft lip, cleft palate. That's certainly one of the indications that possibly for Agent Orange. But the only disease that the VA recognizes at this time is spinal bifida. And spinal bifida is from the male veteran that served. However, there are 14 other conditions if a female served and was exposed to Agent Orange. But when you see a grandparent standing up there and knowing that he's had these birth defects and he's affected his grandchild, it just really, you know, you really feel for them because you have that guilt that you transferred this Agent Orange.
So knowing that there is this sort of element involved that drags through the rest of your life and many other veterans' lives, is there any bitterness or have you had to work past that?
Well, I don't know if there's bitterness. I just wish that the VA would be a little bit more upfront with this. I think, and I've said this and I've testified before Senate, that I think there's a lot of smoke and mirrors with the VA. It was interesting because we had to sue. And in 1991, you know, we won the Niemer decision, and they had to go back to 1984, and they'd open up all the claims that they have, which created a huge backlog. And now that we're getting older, you know, that's just, it's just, you know, perpetuated itself.
Any reason to think that because of what we know now about Agent Orange, that those in the Defense Department, the VA, anybody, is being more communicative to at least say to soldiers, okay, we want you to do this, but here are the risks?
It's about numbers, and it's about money. And I think that's when it boils down to, and they start looking at the overall and what their budget is. And we're starting to see a lot of Gulf War syndrome. You know, they're coming in and filing claims. And the VA has put what they call undiagnosed illness. They know that there was an exposure, but yet they won't admit to it. So you're not, I don't know if you're going to see presumptives, but it will, you know, it's something that we as veterans, we have the right to fight for. And a lot of veterans have been turned down. And my, you know, answer to them is continue to fight.
Chuck Byers is Chief Veterans Service Officer for the Vietnam Veterans of Arizona. An Agent Orange Town Hall will be held tomorrow morning at the First United Methodist Church of Mesa.
3 years ago Monday, a meteor exploded about 16 miles above the Siberian city of Chelyabinsk, injuring more than 1,000 people. Since then, researchers have been working to learn more about that rock and how to prevent similar events from happening in the future. Tim Swindle is one of them. He's the director of the Lunar and Planetary Laboratory at the University of Arizona. Tim, what did we learn from that explosion?
Well, about the situation in general, we have more confirmed than learned. We've confirmed that things can sneak up on us when we didn't expect them and that they have some destructive power. The things we've learned, it actually turns out to be a fascinating rock in its own right. We had enough pieces of it that we were able to figure out that it's had this long, violent history of collisions out in the asteroid belt, ranging from the very earliest parts of the solar system to fairly recently.
How do you go about trying to detect whether or not something might be falling toward the Earth? And what kind of device or machine would you use to do that?
Our detection method right now is just telescopes. Two of the biggest search programs are in southern Arizona, one in the Catalina Mountains and one on Kitt Peak. And they've, between them, discovered about half the asteroids that we know of. The one weakness with that general strategy is the fact that telescopes can only look at night, and the Chelyabinsk meteorite was coming in from the side of the sun, so we literally had no chance in the world of detecting it. It was like a fighter pilot coming in from the sun.
So are researchers working on different ways to try to detect these?
Yes, there is a proposal right now that's in review at NASA for a project that would put a telescope in space, not nearly as sophisticated a telescope as something like the Hubble or the James Webb, but it would be a telescope that would be in an orbit somewhere inside the Earth's orbit so that it could be looking out and seeing things that were still inside the Earth's orbit and could give us some warning of the types of things like Chelyabinsk, and also could find more things, the things that come flying by, make close passes that we don't even know about. We find those if they are on the side away from the sun, but with this we'd be able to find them if they are on the side toward the sun. And we'll find out in a few months or a year whether NASA is going to fly that mission, but I suspect that within 5 or 10 years there will be a mission like that that will fly.
How common is it that something could be flying close enough to the Earth that it could cause a problem for us?
Well, there are two ways to answer that. How common is it for something to come fairly close? Fairly common for something the size of the Chelyabinsk rock. I don't know exactly what the numbers are, but there's probably one like that that flies closer than the moon every month or two. On the other hand, something that causes us problems, well, it's going to cause us problems if it hits. And Chelyabinsk was the biggest object to hit the Earth in about 20 years' time, at least as long as we've been looking with satellites looking down on the Earth and seeing the flashes when something enters the atmosphere. So something that is as big as Chelyabinsk that hits is relatively rare, although it does happen every few decades.
If you detect something that is coming in our direction that may hit and may cause problems, do we have a way of trying to intercept it?
We don't at the moment, and that's one of the issues that NASA just set up a Planetary Defense Coordination Office to look at, is ways to mitigate the hazard. Everything from, are there ways to deflect things that are coming in? And the answer is that only if we catch them decades in advance, which in many cases we do, to are there ways to deal with the potential hazard of something that is going to hit in 2 days' time or 1 day's time, which if we find something just about to hit, that's about the length of time that we'll have. And so the first set involves doing experiments with spacecraft and figuring out how you can nudge asteroids in their orbits. The second part involves dealing with political bodies, FEMA, organizations like that.
Tim Swindle is director of the Lunar and Planetary Laboratory at the University of Arizona. Tim, thank you.
Thank you.
The Greater Phoenix Jewish Film Festival is celebrating its 20th year. It starts on Sunday. And this year, organizers are touting a trio of Holocaust-related movies that are appropriate for younger viewers. Two of the films are French, the other is Dutch. All three movies have English subtitles. Joining me to talk about them and how to talk to kids about the Holocaust are Kim Klatt, an English teacher at Dobson High School and a regional educator with the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum, and festival executive director Bob Sagelbaum. So, Bob, do you try to have something about the Holocaust shown each year?
Well, it turns out that way. We don't make a concerted effort. Since we rely on films being from international, we review what's out there. And, of course, the Holocaust and Holocaust-related subjects is a very strong topic throughout the world. And most of our films are made in Europe. As a matter of fact, many people in our audience say they don't want to see another Holocaust film. They like to be entertained. And Holocaust films generally aren't entertaining.
Kim, you were shaking your head as Bob was saying that these types of films are typically not entertaining. When you hear the phrase family-friendly film about the Holocaust, what do you think that means?
I feel it's something that's appropriate for most ages, maybe 10 and up, where you could take your children and be comfortable, maybe not have to explain too much. You know, it's not too violent or scary, but still gets an important point across.
How do you talk about maybe the themes of what that was without seeing some of the graphic? We're not talking Schindler's List here.
Right.
These are movies that are deal more with the themes that came out during the Holocaust. How do you talk to your kids about that sort of thing and not have to answer some of the questions that they might end up with?
Well, I think a lot of them, they're learning it so much younger. You know, when I first started working with the Holocaust Museum, we said, don't teach it below seventh grade, maybe sixth grade, but, you know, even then, typically not. And now we're seeing it as low as fifth grade, where they're reading some of the books. And so I think kids are probably going home and talking about it, and parents are interested in it. And so, you know, maybe they're trying to learn along with their students and their children. But I think there's a sense of interest at a lot of different age levels.
What do kids that age understand about what they're seeing?
I think they get the sense of right and wrong. They understand that. They know that there are, you know, people who do things that are bad. They don't have to see the extent of it, but they understand that concept, and so they can get that.
Bob, why is it important, do you think, that even kids, you know, we're not talking little kids, but, you know, young adults learn about these kinds of themes, even if they don't know all the details of it, but why is it important to learn about these themes?
I think it's important because we're bombarded by so much information from different sources, and especially now with the internet, there's all kinds of stuff out there on the internet, and some people are denying that the Holocaust ever existed, and these films bring to light that, you know, this event did happen, and people suffered, and are continuing to suffer.
Kim, do you find that your students tend to learn maybe better about these kinds of things when they see it in a movie as opposed to reading a book about it or even maybe seeing something online?
I think it's a great starting point, absolutely. I don't necessarily use a lot of films in my class because they just take a lot of time, but I think it is that great starting point where they see a movie, if you see once in a lifetime, you know, that these kids are inspired by one little piece of information and it just snowballs into something so much bigger.
How do those conversations go when if you show them a film or if you talk about something or maybe read something out of a book? What kinds of things do the kids seem to be curious about? What kinds of questions do they ask you?
Well, I think one of the huge questions is, how could people do this? And so you're looking at choices that people make, not just that there were good and bad, but what choices did people make? Did they choose to do something horrible and you know, go that way? Or did they choose to maybe do something to help others?
Bob, when you talk about films that are not directly necessarily about, like, showing what happened during this time period, is there sort of an audience factor as well? Do you find that audiences are maybe more likely to want to see a movie that can talk about the Holocaust, but maybe in a more indirect way as opposed to seeing it straight on?
I think most audiences today would rather see it indirectly. I think that we've seen so much over the years of direct evidence of the Holocaust. And since our audience is quite broad, but mostly directed towards the older generations, they've seen a lot. So we're trying to attract the younger generations into the films, and hopefully they get a broad picture of what it was like and the ramifications and the effects of the Holocaust on those who suffered and those who were indirectly affected by it.
And unfortunately, I think sometimes that students do want to see the more graphic, and, you know, they'll want that in the classroom, and I tell them we're not going to go there, and I point out how something that's much more subtle can be stronger.
As we get farther away from when this actually happened and more survivors are no longer with us, do you think that this is going to be more the way that film and maybe other media go in terms of not showing you everything that happened, but sort of telling the story in a more indirect way?
Well, I think so. I think we're seeing that. We're seeing a lot of films that even during the festival, the films that may not be directly related to Holocaust, but by inference, you know they had some bearing on the filmmaking.
Bob Sagelbaum is the executive director of the Greater Phoenix Jewish Film Festival, which starts on Sunday. We also heard from Kim Klatt, an English teacher at Dobson High School and a regional educator with the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum.
And Every February for the last 60 years, thousands of people line up in the early morning hours to be the first to get into the exhibit building at the Arizona State Fairgrounds.
They're not lining up for concert tickets or a free TV or a new iPhone. They're lining up for books. Yes, the old-fashioned kind made out of paper and binding.
Tomorrow marks the 60th VNSA book sale, and the show's Lauren Gilger got a sneak peek inside.
The exhibit building at the State Fairgrounds is a massive space. At least a few football fields could fit in here. And today, it's full of books.
These are your picture books, your ABC books, Dr. Seuss, Disney, all of that great stuff.
Sandra Sternweiss begins her tour of the Volunteer National Service Association's annual book sale in her section, children's books.
And then we have a huge vintage or classic children's section. Wow. Where you're going to find originals of Nancy Drew or Alice in Wonderland.
There are rows and rows of tables covered in books, and underneath boxes stacked on top of more boxes full of more books.
Wow, so here we are in health.
The hall has taken about 150 volunteers a week to set up, and they'll need about 1,000 volunteers to staff the two-day sale this weekend.
Then we're starting into our fiction section for adults.
As far as they know, this is the largest book sale in the country, and by the end of the weekend, most of these books will be gone.
Which is divided into suspense, and then general fiction divided by year. And then across from that is the same thing, but in paperback.
VNSA volunteers gather books for the sale all year from drop boxes around the city. They'll come pick them up at your house. They get them from book dealers and publishers and libraries.
We will take any book you want to give me. We are not picky. Because we have categories for everything. We have humor and business, fine arts, cookbooks, house and garden, audiovisual. We have large print and occasionally little braille.
Let's just say by the time the sale rolls around every year, they have a lot of books.
So what are we talking? Tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of books here?
Hundreds of thousands, almost 500,000 books.
Sternweiss says she has 50,000 books in the children's section alone. Today, a handful of volunteers are putting the last-minute touches on the tables of books, and some more are loading up empty boxes onto a semi-truck so they can be used again next year.
We will have 9 semi-trucks full of boxes of books by the time we're ready for next year's sale.
It's what Sternweiss calls the calm before the storm, but soon.
The patrons will start lining up, and they will literally be lining up. There'll be hundreds of people in line before the doors open at 8 o'clock in the morning.
Each year, the VNSA raises several $100,000 for the Arizona Friends of Foster Children Foundation and the Literacy Volunteers of Maricopa County. And even as bookstores fold around the country and e-books take off, the book sale still attracts thousands of book lovers every year.
I think that what we found is that although we were worried people might not want real books anymore, that just is not the case. Most people who come read e-books, but they also want the real book. Because it's not the same to curl up in your chair with your Kindle or your Nook or your iPad as it is to literally have the book, the weight of it, the smell of the paper.
After 60 years, the VNSA book sale has become a ritual for generations of families.
I think that there is a weight of tradition, right? People know when the book sale is. They know where it is. They put it on their calendar.
And in her children's section, Sternweiss says she sees as many adults perusing the books as kids.
And actually, most adults go in there because they'll be like, I remember the Radio Boys. I read that. My dad read that. My grandpa read that. I want that book. And so they buy a memory.
It's the show. I'm Lauren Gilger.
The VNSA book sale starts bright and early tomorrow morning at the Arizona State Fairgrounds.
It's possible you haven't seen a dried gourd since Thanksgiving, when they're used in abundance as centerpieces. But in Casa Grande, gourds are a big deal right now. The show's Annika Klein takes us to the annual gourd festival held there.
The Wirtz Gourd Farm in Casa Grande grows a lot of gourds.
Currently, we are growing about 25 to 30 acres of gourds, which produces about 500,000 gourds a year.
I walk with farm owner Waylon Wirtz past giant bins holding the 34 different varieties of gourds his family grows.
From, let's say, earring size to gourds that you cannot fit your arms around, and every shape in between.
There are stout gourds, twisted gourds, gourds with warts. Why would you want so many different kinds of gourds?
The thing about gourds is they're so versatile. You can carve them, you can burn them, you can inlay them. They're just a wonderful media for any kind of artistic expression.
Linda Hughes is one of more than 100 artists setting up a booth at the Wirtz Farm Gourd Festival. She's unpacking blue, red, and yellow gourd birdhouses. Other artists pull out gourds that have been transformed into useful items like vases or instruments. Some gourds are unrecognizable after the hard outer shell has been carved away to create delicate patterns in the layers underneath. The longer growing season in Arizona actually allows the gourd shells to become thicker, giving artists more room to play without the gourd crumbling into pieces. Other gourds have lent their unusual shape to the body or head of an animal. Kathy Waldo with the Arizona Gourd Society shows me pieces entered into the festival competition. It's so funny because you can kind of see the original gourd shape, but now it looks like a fish.
There are so many that can look at a gourd and go, this is what it looks like to me.
Picking out the perfect gourd is where Deborah Williams starts her creative process. It's not like picking out a blank canvas, she says, because every canvas is different.
It's like a little kid in the candy store. You go out there and, that could be a swan. That could be, that's exactly what I want it to be.
She says after working for a while with gourds, they start to talk to you. They tell you what they're meant to be. And looking around at the hundreds of newly harvested gourds, peeking their necks out of wire bins, you can see the possibilities. It's the show. I'm Anika Klein.
The Gourd Festival is at Pinal County Fairgrounds through Sunday.
And that sounds like a gourd time, especially with Mark's dad, whose name is Gordon.
You had to go there, didn't you?
I had to, yes.
Yeah, okay.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.